It's 5:30. I'm Nora Flaherty, and this is Maine Things Considered. Ahead on the program tonight, Connor McAllister in court today for the stabbing of a 59-year-old woman. A program that helps people understand what happens inside dementia. We'll have those stories and your Maine newscast just ahead, but first, national and world news from NPR. I'm Nora Flaherty with this look at Maine news. The man in charge of national drug control policy, Michael Botticelli, will join Senator Angus King in Maine on Tuesday for a roundtable discussion about how the federal government can help confront the state's opioid epidemic. The discussion at Eastern Maine Healthcare Systems in Brewer will include prevention and treatment experts, people in recovery, families dealing with addiction, healthcare providers, and law enforcement. King says he wants the conversation with Botticelli to highlight suggestions that both Maine and Washington can use.
I hope that we're going to learn something from him of what he's seeing around the country and how people similarly situated are coping with this problem. But also, I think there are some messages that need to be delivered to Washington in terms of how they can be most helpful in dealing with these problems, a lack of beds, a lack of treatment. So I think it's going to be a two-way street.
King says the event was planned weeks ago before Governor LePage announced that he would convene a drug summit with a primary focus on law enforcement. That's also scheduled for next week. King says he thinks the two discussions will complement each other. And Maine Health and Human Services Commissioner Mary Mayhew says the state's doing all it can under federal law to stop the trafficking in electronic benefit cards intended to distribute assistance to poor Mainers. Mayhew says she's very upset at EBT cards being used by drug dealers. She says one indication that cards are being misused is people seeking several replacements. She says while the state can't limit the number of replacement cards, the department is requiring people seeking a fourth replacement to go to a DHHS office and explain why they keep losing them.
That we can do, but the federal government does not allow us to deny them access to that card, to that replacement card.
Mayhew says because federal law won't allow the state to require photos on the cards, Maine set up a voluntary program. She says thousands of Maine-issued cards now have photos on them, which she believes deters trafficking. Mayhew says fraud could be greatly reduced if Congress allowed some simple reforms. In weather tonight, thunder ending, but showers continuing, very clammy and foggy with lows in the 60s. Tomorrow, a little sun, but also lots of showers throughout the state. Muggy with highs in the 60s along the coast to low 80s inland. Sunday, rain and a chance of thunder with highs in the 70s. This is MPBN Radio. We're online at mpbn.net. It's 25 minutes before 6. This is Maine Things Considered on MPBN Radio. I'm Nora Flaherty. A man charged with stabbing a woman to death at a Shaw's supermarket in Saco did not enter a plea this afternoon at his first court appearance. According to an affidavit filed with the York County Superior Court, Connor McAllister targeted Wendy Boutreau in the parking lot of the supermarket, followed her to the ice cream aisle, and slit her throat. Judge John O'Neill Jr. ordered Connor McAllister held without bail as the case heads to a grand jury. Jay Field reports.
McAllister's hearing, scheduled for 1 p.m., was late getting underway. It wasn't until roughly 1:40 that sheriff's deputies led the defendant into the courtroom.
All rise.
McAllister stood in front of the bench to the left of Judge O'Neill, expressionless. Family members of Wendy Boudreau, the 59-year-old mother and grandmother he's accused of killing, huddled close to one another on benches on the right side of the courtroom. Some wept as Judge O'Neill ran through some initial questions. Did the defendant understand he's being charged with intentional or knowing murder? Yes, answered Robert LeBrasser, McAllister's court-appointed defense attorney. McAllister did not enter a plea and was ordered held without bail. Later, outside the courthouse, reporters asked LeBrasser about his client's state of mind.
I have no comment.
LeBrasser, though, was willing to discuss the state's request that Connor McAllister undergo a mental evaluation to determine his competency to stand trial. Judge O'Neill granted the order requiring the psychiatric evaluation over LeBrasser's objection, but took the issue of determining McAllister's fitness for trial off the table for now.
What the order does is allow state forensics to evaluate Mr. McAllister for mental health defenses, commonly known as the insanity defense.
The results of that mental evaluation will be impounded unless LaBrosseur ultimately decides to pursue an insanity defense on behalf of his client. Questions surrounding Connor McAllister's mental health have been raised in the days since Wednesday afternoon's deadly attack. McAllister, who was born Tanisha Hopkins, is female-to-male transgender, who has identified as male for more than 10 years, according to a Portland Press Herald interview with the suspect's brother. According to the Biddeford police, McAllister once had an address at a group home in the city. Most recently, he lived at an Avesta housing complex in Saco for older adults with disabilities.
We've had contact with Connor McAllister over the past several years.
But not the sort of contact, says Brad Paul, that led law enforcement to believe that McAllister was capable of such a gruesome crime. Paul is chief of police in Saco.
And I can't go into the depth or detail, you know, of those contacts at this point in time. I believe that as this process unfolds, you know, the more context I think will come out with respect to our contacts and or other agencies' contacts or the contacts of the suspect with relation to the overall system. I think all of that comes out. I think at this point it is still being investigated and is still a part of the investigation.
A reading of the affidavit charging McAllister with Wendy Boudreau's murder offers a hint at the role that mental illness may have played in the crime. Two people who confronted McAllister moments after he allegedly slit Boudreau's throat asked him why he'd done it. "I'm off my meds, and I didn't mean to do it," McAllister allegedly told one witness. "She looked at me funny." For MPBN News, I'm Jay Field.
Millions of Americans living with dementia experience a confusing and distorted personal reality, and it's hard for loved ones and caregivers to understand what that's like. One nursing home down east is offering a 20-minute simulation experience called a virtual dementia tour. It's designed to give the user a brief but powerful sense of the world they can only witness from the outside. Eliza Lambert reports.
Wearing a pair of vision-restricting sunglasses, you layer two pairs of gloves on your hands and place spiked pads in your shoes. You wrap noise-canceling headphones over your ears, and the audio track in the background makes everything a garbled mess of sound. The woman holding your hand recites five basic tasks for you to complete.
First of all, I want you to find the white sweater.
But you can't make out her words. She leads you into a typical patient room, but it's dark, and strobe lights are pulsing in every corner. You feel the door close behind you, and your heartbeat quickens. You know you're supposed to do something, but you aren't sure what. So you just wander. This is what it's like to undergo Island Nursing Home and Care Center's virtual dementia tour.
This is the most complicated sweater I've ever been in.
That's me trying to wear a towel during the tour. That's how confusing everything is when simulating and living with dementia.
The greatest form of respect we can give is to walk in someone else's shoes.
That's Becky Seibert, residential care director at the nursing home, where all employees, regardless of job title, are required to participate in the simulation. She says the tour is a training in empathy, which she believes is the only way to treat patients.
The best way to care for someone with dementia is to know that person, know their history, know what they loved in life, their family, what they may have been scared of.
Island Nursing Home and Care Center in Deer Isle began offering the simulation 2 years ago as a way to raise awareness in the community for the anticipated influx of elders with dementia.
5.3 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease today, and by 2050, the number is to range upward to 16 million people, and that's just Alzheimer's disease.
The tour is orchestrated by Second Wind Dreams, a nonprofit corporation in Georgia. Over the course of 13 years, researchers compiled the symptoms, behaviors, and complaints of dementia patients and created GARB to recreate the disease for loved ones.
When anybody, you and I, garb up and we go into the tour, very soon we start exhibiting behaviors, the same behaviors as someone with dementia or similar.
This method of learning may not be the most gentle.
My anxiety level just spiked the minute I began the actual tour.
Very scary. Yes. Very disorientating.
But if empathy is the goal, it serves its purpose.
It horrifies me to think that people go through that and live with that. It horrifies me.
And yes, this did bring me to tears, no question about it.
Participant Laura Lyle says the experience hit her close to home.
As a daughter, I'm sure I'll be more empathetic towards my mother. At least I'd like to think that I will be.
According to Second Wind Dreams, the virtual tour has been experienced by 1 million people in 17 countries and is used in 200 colleges and universities as adjunct curriculum. For MPBN News, I'm Eliza Lambert.
And the Island Nursing Home plans to offer the virtual dementia tour again this November. Finally today, it's been a good season for the endangered piping plover. Populations of the tiny migrating shorebirds that like to nest in the sandy beaches of southern and mid-coast Maine during the summer were dangerously low a few years ago. But this year, thanks in large part to local communities, monitors have observed the highest numbers on record. Tom Porter visited one of those communities.
Ryan Wynn walks along Ferry Beach in Scarborough towards Western Beach, which lies adjacent to it. Both shorelines, he says, are favourite summer nesting places for piping plovers. Wynn is the beach monitoring coordinator for the town of Scarborough. He was hired last spring to keep an eye on shorebird nesting areas and educate the public about how they can avoid harming the piping plovers, small white-breasted creatures with matchstick legs.
It's been a good 15 months. You can look at the numbers. We've had increased fledgling rates, increased number of pairs on our beaches. The amount of volunteers we've been getting for the town program has increased steadily since last year.
Wynn oversees 46 volunteers covering Scarborough's four beaches. One of them is retired schoolteacher Glenys Chabot, who patrols nearby Higgins Beach twice a day from April until September. She looks for nests and is also there to educate members of the public, especially dog owners.
People are not sign readers. You know, we have signs posted everywhere. I understand that because I'm not a real sign reader. You know, don't put anything up at Hannaford you want me to read because I'll never see it.
The killing of a nesting plover 2 years ago by an unleashed dog on Pine Point Beach resulted in a new town beach ordinance restricting canine activity. Half of Higgins Beach is now closed to dogs over the summer, says Chabot, while the other half allows supervised pets off the leash between 7 and 9 a.m. No dogs at all are permitted anywhere on the beach between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., when they're allowed back for a further 3 hours, as long as they're leashed. Chabot says most local residents are now aware of the rules and follow them. But it's often a different story, she says, for summer visitors.
We have so many new people here every day that aren't aware of the rules, and so we talk to a lot of people.
And what's the response you typically get?
A lot of support, a lot of thank yous for doing this.
But not everyone was happy with the prospect of new restrictions.
Certainly there was resistance.
Scarborough town manager Tom Hall says there was no question that action had to be taken. The dog attack incurred the wrath of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which threatened the town with a $12,000 fine. Hall says the crafting of the ordinance was something of a balancing act.
Oftentimes my job, I do find myself trying to find that happy place in the middle. And our beaches are something that, for obvious reasons, everyone wants access to. And I think this is a demonstration that there are ways to craft public policy and rules and regulations that achieve that level of balance. Is everyone happy entirely? Probably not.
Certainly the feds were not entirely happy, says Hall. They would prefer no unleashed dogs on the beach at all during that critical nesting period. Nevertheless, they still welcome the new ordinance and dropped the threat of a fine. And they may be encouraged by the latest statewide numbers, which show 62 nesting pairs of piping plovers and 121 fledgling chicks, the best figures since intensive monitoring began in 1981, says Laura Zitsky from the Maine Audubon's Piping Plover and Lease Tern project. She says the results are in large part due to the hard work of people in places like Scarborough.
We have people in all the communities really taking ownership over the beach and over the birds and watching out for them and educating people.
Meanwhile, back on Western Beach in Scarborough, it looks like the remainder of this season's piping plovers have departed, explains Ryan Wynn as he points to the stretch of sand where the last nest had been.
When did you last see one here?
A couple days ago.
Mm.
So I think it's pretty safe to say that they've flown the coop.
Summer is over. It's official.
Summer is over. The plovers are gone.
Gone south, he says, heading to the mid-Atlantic before wintering in the Bahamas. Not a bad life if you can avoid the predators. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
And at 13 minutes before 6 o'clock, it's time to check the weather forecast with our meteorologist, Paul Cousins.
We are lodged in the sluiceway of saturated tropical air. Torrential showers with isolated thunder will slowly abate overnight from south to north, fewest down east. Drizzle and fog will reemerge, 60 statewide. Tomorrow, somewhat similar to today's weather, once the morning fog thins across the state, partly sunny over northern and western Maine with isolated afternoon showers and thunder. Throughout central and southern Maine, maybe a few glimpses of sunshine inland with afternoon showers and thunderstorms reigniting. Along the entire coastal plain, foggy with just scattered afternoon showers. Temperatures near 80 well inland to the upper 60s along the down east coast. Sunday, foggy and soggy with showers and possible thunderstorms. 75 to 80 inland, near 70 down east. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.
And that's Maine Things Considered. Thanks today to Ed Morin, Barbara Caridi, Susan Sharon, and Keith Shortall. I'm Nora Flaherty.